The reading this morning is really just a few lines from Dina Metzger, who is a poet and she's everything. Poet, activist, philosopher, world changer. Without compassion, we will never know anyone or anything, not even our own story. Too much judgment, too many ideas, and attitudes will stand in the way of the fundamental principle that we are similar to, connected with, and part of everything else. The title of my sermon today is a poem, actually, by Dina Metzger, and it's a poem that I saw when I was riding on the bus in San Francisco, I think. It's just 5 words, and I can still remember that moment sitting on the bus and looking up and seeing this little poem up there and thinking, oh, these cracked cups hold water. I have met a few evangelists in my life who have really persuaded me. I met one in the produce section of a food co-op where I was volunteering in the summer of 1993. He came in with a huge basket of yellow squash, those patty pan squash. They're kind of round like the sun, beautiful. He was putting them out and he gave me a little bag to take home. He insisted that they were a gift and that I was not to pay for them. And then he piled up the rest in a big display. And I got to know him as he delivered more produce from his farm over the summer, frequently insisting that I take some of it home. He would also show up with jars of fresh-made carrot juice, and he insisted that whoever was in the vicinity drink it immediately, because that's when it was at its best. He was an evangelist for organic farming. And it wasn't long before he had me out on his farm, out at the end of town. He had me over for meals. He had, I think, maybe everyone in town over for a meal at some point. And he got me and a lot of people helping out in the gardens. Later, I thought, how did he arrange for all that free labor? But he wasn't thinking of it as free labor. He was really, truly believing that it was good for all of us to be out there working the earth. He was a true believer in whole foods and farming and organic farming, in an honest and deep relationship with the land. He knew everyone in town, and those he hadn't yet converted to organic farming, he kept talking to in the hopes that he would win them over. And he grew beautiful food and flowers. And he always had a few hired farmhands who he had found through some network, and they were part of this evangelism movement, really. And he would exclaim over the beauty of the peas and the delphinium, the superior flavor of an organic tomato. He had greenhouses, one of which he kept warm in the spring with a wood stove, which he woke up in the night to stoke. He was really committed to this. Well, I moved off to San Francisco and on to other things. And then a couple of years ago, I discovered that he had died. And he had died quite young, really, of colon cancer. He had had symptoms but never been checked. I think partially he believed in organic farming so much that he thought that wouldn't happen to him. But then I learned another part of his story, which made me realize that it was more complicated. After he died, and probably before he died, they had discovered that while he had been feeding everyone in town this beautiful organic food, he was, whenever he could, I think, sneaking off to McDonald's and eating those, in addition to McDonald's, those donuts, you know, the little tiny donuts that are in these little wrappers. You can buy them, I think, at the gas station. They're not the peak of culinary experience, but
donuts.
And he was stuffing the wrappers under the seat of his truck. He was having this little parallel food life. He believed in wholesome food and in organic, homegrown everything. He built his whole life around that. And then he was sneaking off and doing this other thing, which he didn't believe in. Well, he had some broken parts in his heart that he just couldn't figure out how to live with, and soul pain leads us to do strange things. There's a little way that he undercut his own work by sneaking around and eating this food that he often said he was against. It would have been a little different, I think, if he had openly, laughingly gone off to McDonald's and said, you know, sometimes you just have to do this. Because we all get to be complicated. But he didn't do that. He snuck around like he thought it was wrong. And he did think it was wrong. When I learned this about his life, I was sad. Sad mostly that he had carried this pain and confusion, that he hadn't been able to grapple with his own contradictions and maybe share them with other people. And we all do this in some part. Something that we say we believe in or don't believe in, and then we do the opposite, and sometimes we can't even notice that we're doing it. Or sometimes we're sort of aware, and so we do it a little quietly if we can. And then it undercuts our beliefs and our best selves. And I think sometimes that we, when we learn that about other people and even about ourselves, these ways that we fail or just are confused, we undercut and dismiss each other's ability to, well, carry water, make a difference in the world. It's easy to think when we learn these things or notice these things that it saps the meaning out of what we do. I remember going through the art museums in Chicago after I had taken a women's studies class. As I walked through those galleries that I had, in fact, walked through often before that, I suddenly saw Western art as this long saga of sexism, which I had never seen before. And I realized that I just couldn't have anything to do with Western art anymore. It's just all of that beauty and light. It was just this, the presence of this one thing just meant that it was, I had to dismiss all of it. I was 19. I was sorting things out about what you can trust and how you believe when the world suddenly shifts in your understanding of things. So a few years later, I realized that if I dismissed all of Western art, and it's a lot of art, just because it showed that the humans who had made the art had some confusions or limitations, that then I missed all of the chances that were there on those canvases or in those sculptures or in the music. I missed all of the chances to glimpse the moments of transcendence that they also had to offer. The way the light falls in the window and makes us believe that there is something more. That's stunning, even if part of the story that's there also has sexism in it. We get them both in the same painting and in the same life, the same breath. The failings and the transcendence. So I think grappling with Western art is when I began to really learn compassion. And I think that's what I got to grapple with my farmer friend. It's always both. And then I encountered Brené Brown's definition of compassion. She says the core of compassion is being able to accept other people. And she said that she learned that she couldn't accept other people until she learned to actually talk to them about what was going on. She'd spent a lot of her life being quiet and sweet, which is one of the ways that the sexism in Western art plays out in life, is that women tend to not just say what they're thinking, they tend to be sweet. And she'd figured out, all right, that's not a long-term plan. Because I want to be really close to people. And being sweet means there's always a gap. There's some part of my mind that's kind of off here sneaking other thoughts instead of just, all right, here it is. So she said part of learning compassion has been now she's not as sweet as she used to be, but she thinks she's a lot kinder. So living in her compassion has meant being clear about her boundaries, she says. She says that compassion and boundaries are interwoven completely. And her definition of boundaries is, this is okay with me, this is not okay with me. And then saying or acting on those principles. Which seems tremendously simple, doesn't it? And then she says you have to talk about what the consequences are if you've told someone what's okay with you or not okay with you and they aren't able to act on that. So I thought about this. So if I had known, as this Iowa farmer was handing me this jar of freshly, it's not squeezed carrot juice. Wait, how do you make carrot juice? You can't squeeze it. Grated carrot juice, and saying, you have to drink it right now because that's when it's at its best. If I had known that he was also struggling with eating food that he didn't believe in, what would I have said to him? And I thought, oh, I would say, it's not okay with me that you are disrespecting yourself. Which is a hard thing to say to someone else. And I don't know that he would have changed anything if I or anyone else had said that to him. But probably there would have been a connection there that hadn't been present before. There wouldn't be something hidden in the relationship. And then the true accepting of each other can begin. Then we can see each other in our transcendence as well as our limitations, instead of always sort of tripping over the limitations that we inevitably have. So compassion is being accepting about what is, all of what is. And it's easier to accept each other fully when we are not quietly humping over our boundaries and not talking or clearly acting on those. And this is the spiritual practice of almost all of the world religions, figuring out how to be right where we are and communicate it to other people so that they can be right where they are. And this is how we practice truly belonging to each other.